Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We've had an overflow crowd, and we had to charge everyone to keep the audience in to that we don't overflow too much. And so it's glad everyone. I'm pleased everyone's cooperating. Everyone's here, and Gladys Berejiklian, the Liberal member for. What's it called again? Willoughby, not far from where Anne and I live, has been generous to host this tonight, and she's going to start proceedings. Gladys, thanks.
Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who know Gerard Henderson, he's very generous to give me 5 seconds to welcome you all. So on behalf of the State Parliamentary Team, especially the State Liberal Party, I'd like to welcome you all to Parliament House and say what an honour and pleasure it is for me to host tonight's Sydney Institute function. And no doubt, as you all know, the subject matter this evening is a constant and ongoing source of inspiration for many Liberals around the country, including myself. So it's a double pleasure to be able to host tonight's function. No doubt, this is the New South Wales Parliament is the mother of all parliaments, and I'm looking forward to the mother of all presentations this evening. So welcome, and join me in enjoying tonight's presentation, and I look forward to seeing you again at Parliament House. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gladys. So we're going to start off with Peter Coleman, and he's going to speak for about 10 minutes. Then we go to Peter Costello, who will speak for about 20 minutes or thereabouts. Then we'll take questions and discussion in no later than 7 p.m. And Janet Grundy from Next Chapter Books has got some copies of the Costello memoirs outside, and I'm sure Peter and the two Peters will be happy to sign it. So we lead off with Peter Coleman. Many thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Gerard, and thank you, Gladys. I hope I can be as brisk and to the point and even as amusing as Gladys. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you may think it remarkable that Peter Costello and I ever managed to co-write these memoirs. The book is partly, or in part, a personal statement, an autobiography, and good autobiographies. I don't mean celebrity autobiographies written by ghosts, but good autobiographies are usually the heartfelt work of one person only. Co-authorship is possible, and we did it, but it is at times difficult and touchy. Not perhaps as difficult as co-authoring a poem, say a love poem, or co-composing a concerto. That's almost impossible, but it's difficult and rare just the same. But the Costello Memoirs is not only autobiography, it's also political history or journalism and polemic, where co-authorship often works well. A year or two ago, I co-authored a biography of a controversial economist, Heinz Arendt. It's a life and time story, not unlike the Costello Memoirs. The co-authors of that biography collaborated easily, and that emboldened me to take on collaboration with Peter Costello. How did it happen? The story of the book begins early this year when several of Peter's friends, colleagues and family, including me, but more particularly his wife, my daughter Tanya, were urging him to place on record his account of his momentous years in public life from, say, the dramatic or melodramatic Dollar Sweets case through to the catastrophe, the electoral catastrophe of 24 November 2007. It would be an insider's story, and a contribution, a major one, to political literature. Louise Adler of Melbourne University Publishing added her authority and enthusiasm to the idea. But Peter wasn't so sure. He felt, some of you may be a little surprised to hear, a certain modesty. He had written many speeches and addresses over the years of several thousand words, but never anything longer than that. He'd never written a book, and to turn out 140,000 words in a few months was a big ask. And this is where I came in. Louise Adler thought I should be able to help. I'd written a few books. I had spent some years in state and federal politics and knew something of the splendours and miseries of parliamentary and ministerial life. I was an admirer of Peter Costello. We trusted each other. So we talked over Louise Adler's suggestion and decided to give it a go. We had to first settle on some ground rules. I don't mean anything signed and sealed. You don't need such formality when you have trust. But we agreed on a rough division of labour, a timetable, and a programme of meetings in Sydney or Melbourne or Canberra whenever we needed more than telephones or faxes or emails. We soon fixed on the main themes. That was the easy part. Then we wrote, discussed, debated, edited, and rewrote each chapter as we worked our way through the narrative. You may be able to pick out a paragraph here and there and say, that was obviously written by Costello and that by Coleman, especially if you have an eye or an ear for that sort of thing, but it won't always be easy. The co-authorship worked. Peter had few complaints about my part in the final draft, and I did not even consider quibbling about what Peter had to say about his term as governor of the IMF or amending what he had to say about his personal life. It's his story, his memoirs, not mine, and I didn't want to emulate that famous German scholar who edited the prose works of Goethe, the great German poet. At one point in one essay, Goethe wrote, "With her, for the first time in my life, I really fell in love." The scholar immediately added a Teutonic footnote. Here, a Goethe was in error. That scholar was not my model. There were some unresolvable differences of opinion. I am a true believer federalist who does not share Peter's centralist hostility to the states. Some laughter. I also have... I'm glad it was funny about something. I also have more reservations about the Republic than he has. I'm a paid-up member of Les Murray's Republican branch of Australians for Constitutional Monarchy. But these... You know how much time goes into working out these jokes. But these and other points of continuing disagreement are small details in the big picture the book paints, the age of prosperity and Peter Costello's role in it. I had no wish or reason to press our disagreements. In any case, he was persuasive enough for me to reconsider my own position on some matters. For example, Peter's support of the reconciliation walk and the apology to the Aborigines for their dispossession and related grievances, while I was somewhat sceptical about the lasting value of such symbolic gestures. But I came to see merit in his argument that some symbolic gestures, such as an apology, have their own potency, especially when combined with practical measures, such as the Northern Territory intervention. I commend, ladies and gentlemen, chapter 11 to you, the one titled From Mabo to Mal. I should add, I've read with some bemusement headlines and stories in the press about poison pens and revenge attacks. I'm here to say that this is tendentious, wrong-headed and wrong. As a co-author, I know what I wanted to do and I know what Peter wanted to do. That is, state facts, correct errors and present Peter's point of view, fairly and where possible in a good-humoured way. Any poison or revengefulness is in the eye or the mind or the pen of the beholder. There were indeed some occasions in early drafts where I expressed myself more caustically than Peter thought just and reasonable in judgments on the government's defeat in November. He persuaded me to temper my language, and please note that whatever criticisms the book makes of John Howard, it is also generous to him. Some would say over-generous. For example, in an interview referred to in the book, Peter Costello describes him as, with the possible exception of Sir Robert Menzies, Australia's greatest Prime Minister. There were some other difficulties. Peter and I had some problems with prose style. Politicians, as certainly Michael Bohm here tonight will agree, politicians and writers are chalk and cheese. I used to be a politician, but I've spent 20 years purging myself. A good writer is allergic to obscure language, but a good politician knows that there will be times when obscurity, whether instinctive or calculated, will be useful. It helps buy time, keep options open until the right moment. Sometimes an essential tool to get into the habit of it. This sometimes made for a certain tension, but Peter Costello in prose, as in politics, is not predictable. His style and fluency changed during the writing of the book. In the beginning, he would provide notes, rough, detailed notes, which I would add to other raw material and try to transmute into a chapter or two. But Peter quickly learnt the writer's knack. He soon began delivering chapters that called for minimum input from the co-author. There's no doubt that history will judge Peter Costello as a treasurer rather than as a stylist, but in the course of our co-authorship... Well, I think so, I'm pretty sure. But in the course of our co-authorship, he became a writer, and a good one. He will not be as diffident as he once was when he signs up with Louise Adler for the next volume of his memoirs, whether they be about federal politics or some other calling. And he won't be looking for a co-author. A couple of weeks ago, when we were launching this book in Canberra, one critic, a novelist and clairvoyant, Thomas Keneally, prophesied that the Costello memoirs will not be read in 300 years' time. He may be right, ladies and gentlemen. But in the meantime, I recommend it to you. Peter and I are proud of this book. We await your sentence.
Thanks, Peter. According to an informed commentator on Radio National Breakfast yesterday morning, in 300 years' time, I'll be all underwater, so you'll need a waterproof edition of the Costello memoir. Peter Costello.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. It's great to be back here at the Sydney Institute, and can I say to Peter Coleman, thank you for those very articulate words and showing what a fine wordsmith you in fact are. There's one point at which I disagree with you. You said you used to be a politician, but you've spent 20 years purging yourself. I, of course, am still a politician, and I've spent 20 years perjuring myself. Between the two of us, we're still both in business. If I have one criticism of our side of politics is it doesn't take history or ideas seriously enough. And you only have to get into the business of writing books and reading reviews of your books and seeing them serialised to realise that most of the reviewers and most of the writers and most of the critics come from the left or the progressive side of politics. There aren't many on our side. And I thought for that reason it was important that somebody on our side of politics, the right of centre side of politics, actually take the time to write something of the history of our government before it was written for us. To actually tell the story before the story got rewritten. And the rewriting of history began really on the day after the election, as I watched Mr. Rudd and Mr. Swan begin to try and tell the Australian public how bad the Australian economy really was. They've changed their tune somewhat, I've noticed, now that there's financial instability around the world. And they now tell us how strong our economy is and how well prepared we are for the challenges. It apparently doesn't cause them to ask who strengthened it and who got us prepared for these challenges, but we'll take that backhanded compliment wherever we can find it. In my political experience, governments have changed infrequently, and you can see recurring patterns when they do. I remember the change of government in 1975 when Fraser defeated Whitlam. Australia was suffering from double-digit inflation, unemployment was rising, the economy was souring. There was a reason. why the public turned and defeated the Whitlam government. In 1983, Australia was in the midst of severe drought and recession when Hawke defeated Fraser. And I think, again, the economy turned a potent force in the hands of an opposition to vote out a government. I would say it was much the same in March of 1996 when the Keating government was defeated and our own government, led by John Howard, was elected. In March of 1996, we'd been through a deep recession. Unemployment was still over 8%. Interest rates were higher than they are today. The budget was in deep deficit. I think the public would have got rid of Keating earlier. We would have won the 1993 election had it not been for some genius on our side of politics. I'm not talking about one person there. I'm talking about all of us engaging in genius and losing an unlosable election. So how do you explain the November 2007 defeat of the Howard government? As I write in this book, in many respects we've been through an age of prosperity. This has been the longest period of economic growth in Australia's history. Net household wealth tripled. It tripled in 11 years from 1996 to 2007. Unemployment had fallen to 4%. We were nearly in full employment. Interest rates were lower when we were voted out of office than when we came into office. We'd paid off government debt. We'd balanced the budget. And if I were looking for a recurring pattern in history, the 2007 election doesn't share the same analysis of 75, 83 or 96, much more the analysis of 1972, when the McMahon government was voted out of office. And I asked this question in the book, how is it that a government which had created such a period of prosperity, whose economic record was the envy of the world, was voted out of office in November 2007? And I try and I answer that question. In my analysis, it wasn't that the public was angry with the government, it wasn't that the public felt that the government had failed, but the public wanted change. And that's why I pair this election with 1972. And if the Liberal Party, the Liberal coalition government, didn't give the public change, the public was going to give the Liberal government change. And it did that emphatically by voting it out of office and unfortunately voting John Howard out in his own seat of Bennelong. And the lesson that I want to draw from that, a lesson I hope that the Liberal Party will take to heart, is that a political party, like a business, like a charity, like a school, has to focus on succession planning. That any organisation that wants to live beyond one chief executive or one leader, no matter how good they are, knows that they have to focus on succession planning. That we mismanaged our succession planning and our leadership transition. We were caught at the end of November 2007 by an electorate which was not angry, but by an electorate which had stopped listening to a government which had thought it had a long run and was nearing the end of its time. The Labor Party, in fact, has figured this out. When the New South Wales electorate had stopped listening to Bob Carr, he stood down in favour of Maurice Yemma. We may now all realise how hoodwinked we were by this leadership transition and this fresh face, but it managed to give the Labor government in New South Wales another term. Beattie did the same in Queensland, standing down in favour of Anna Bligh. In Victoria, Steve Brax has just done the same in favour of John Brumby. Gallup in Western Australia stood down for Carpenter. Lennon stood down in Tasmania. The Labor Party has much more of a cultural understanding of party and of politics. And in the final chapter, I say that the Labor Party has the cult of party, the Liberal Party has the cult of leadership. And there are historical reasons why that is the case. But the cult of leadership has not always served the Liberal Party well. And certainly hasn't served it well in recent years, where it now finds itself, although recently elected in Western Australia, found itself out of office in every state and territory and at the federal level for a period in 2008. I have a chapter in this book on leadership, and obviously that's the one that's excited most of the press. I trace the leadership discussions, the manoeuvrings between John Howard, myself and others from December of 1994 to 2003, the 64th birthday, to the Athens Declaration after the 2004 election, to the APEC meeting in September of 2007, and it's a fascinating story. I described the week of the APEC meeting here in Sydney almost exactly a year ago as a week of madness. This was Australia's largest diplomatic event ever. We had here in Sydney the President of the United States, George Bush, the President of China, Hu Jintao, the President of Russia, Vladimir Putin. We've never had a President of Russia ever come to Australia before. And over three successive days, the senior ministers had meetings with each of those leaders, Bush, Hu Jintao, Putin. And during those meetings, we were discussing Afghanistan and Iran and Iraq. We were discussing the emergence of China. I remember vividly at Kirribilli House at a dinner with George Bush discussing the US subprime crisis, then only beginning to emerge in September of 2007. And whilst these face-to-face meetings were going on between John Howard and his senior ministers, the moment they finished, the senior ministers were meeting at the Prime Minister's request, deciding whether or not they would ask him to leave office. We were in parallel universes, discussing on the one hand the problems of the world as if nothing had ever changed, and on the other hand, behind the scenes, discussing whether or not we would implement one of the biggest changes in Australia that you could imagine. Namely a transition of leadership and the Prime Ministership. And it illustrated to me how much of politics is conducted at the shop front window level to the public, whilst real decisions are being made behind the scenes, out the back in the workshop where it's all being put together. Bismarck, the Chancellor of Germany, once said there are two things you should never see. One is how sausages are made, and the other is how politics is made. And these discussions were going on behind the scene as little as a year ago. In our government, which commenced in March of 1996 and finished in November of 2007, there were three people that were there for the whole period. They were John Howard, Alexander Downer and myself. I was there on day one. I was there when it all went down. And it was an extraordinary period. It was a very long period. Because the three of us were in that government for the whole duration, Howard became the second longest serving Prime Minister in Australia's history. Downer became the longest serving Foreign Minister in Australia's history. And I became the longest serving Treasurer in Australia's history. In fact, delivering 12 budgets, I've delivered more than 10% of the federal budgets in the whole of Australian history. Now, people say that's a great accolade. I say, well, if I'd have been any better, I'd have got myself out of that job and into another one before I'd delivered, in fact, 12 of them. And it was an extraordinarily productive period, at least in the economic sense. I'm very confident about the judgment of history I think when the history of this period is written, it will be judged one of the greatest economic periods that we've ever experienced. It was certainly the longest period of continuous economic expansion that we've ever experienced. The greatest accumulation of household wealth that we've ever experienced. And we recovered for the first time since the 1960s and the 1970s to a position of full employment. In fact, by the time the government was voted out, you began to hear a phrase you hadn't heard in Australia for 30 or 40 years, labour shortage. Our opponents think this is a bad thing, you know. Oh, what a terrible government. There were labour shortages. Nobody talked about labour shortages back in 1996. They were talking about job shortages. And labour shortage is something that re-entered the Australian lexicon at the beginning of 2000, when we had more jobs than people, rather than more people than jobs, that were chasing them around. But I also try to recount in the book some of the amusing ways in which politics and personality interacted. I do that because I want people to actually read the book. There was an editorial published in the Asian Wall Street Journal yesterday on the book, and it's entitled "A How to Run an Economy Manual." Now, that's a very kind thing to say, but how many people will buy this book if they think it's a How to Run an Economy Manual? I want to tell you, it's much more interesting than that. That's in there, but there are other things that are around it. For example, I'll never forget when I went to Canberra to do my first budget in 1996. We'd gone through a whole election campaign being told the budget was in balance. 2 days after the election, I was told that wasn't the truth. In fact, the budget deficit was around about 1.5% of GDP. And the first term of our government would be dominated by efforts to try and get the budget into balance, something that Australia hadn't experienced for quite some time. I flew up to Canberra with Tanya, my wife, to deliver the budget, and my mother came around to look after our children. My son, Sebastian, was 9 years of age at the time. And when the time came to deliver the budget, my mother, his grandmother, said, "Come and watch TV, we'll watch Dad deliver the budget." And Sebastian, at the age of nine, said, "Nah, that's boring." She said, "Oh no, it may not be boring. No. It's very interesting. Dad's a very good speaker. You'll like hearing what he's got to say." "Nah, that's boring." She said, "Well, you haven't even seen it. How do you know it's boring?" And Sebastian, age nine, said, "I went into his study yesterday and the speech was on the desk and I read it." I remember telling the press this story, and sure enough, a year later, on the day before the budget, the phone rings at home. I answer it. It's Laurie Oakes here. "So, good day, Laurie, how are you? I was wondering if I could speak to Sebastian." "I want to ask him if he's been reading any speeches on your desk." And of course, interweaved with all of these events are the personal stories of many of my colleagues, and some of the humorous anecdotes of what actually happened. The press have obviously focused on leadership issues, but the book is much more serious than just that. It tells the story of our fiscal history, how monetary policy got made, the story of the GST, certainly something that is seared into my mind, and the difficulties of implementing it. Some of these achievements are taken for granted now, and no one would suggest for a moment reversing them. But they were hard fought at the time. And introducing the GST, where we changed the price of 3 billion goods and services on one night, was a reform of mammoth proportions. In fact, unbeknownst to me, I started grinding my teeth in my sleep at night, worrying about the implementation of GST. My dentist prescribed the need for a gold crown. And when I went to the dentist to have it fitted, he pulled out the gold crown and looked at it, and he started laughing. And he said, "Oh, the technician's got a sense of humour." I said, why is that? And he said, "He's engraved the initials GST on this gold crown and stuck it in my mouth." He said, "If we ever need to identify you from dental records, you could well be the only Australian with GST engraved on his teeth." It gave me great confidence, actually. If I should ever die in an accident, somewhere out there is a gold crown which belongs only to me. We went through a financial crisis at the end of 1997, where we had an East Asian financial and economic collapse. I'll never forget it, going to work on Christmas Day 1997, because I was authorising a $1 billion loan to Korea, which had run out of foreign reserves. And the Korean government was appealing to its citizens to donate gold jewellery to the government, and they were queuing to donate their gold jewellery to rebuild the Korean foreign reserves. I've often mused about that. Imagine in Australia asking Australians to donate their gold jewellery to a tax office to rebuild. Do you think we'd get queues outside the tax office of Australians doing their little bit to try and rebuild our economy? But I learned a few lessons coming out of that financial crisis, how important financial regulation is. And that's one of the reasons why we set up our regulatory system with the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, APRA. It's one of the reasons why we were much tighter on credit standards than the United States throughout that period. And it's one of the reasons why we began the great task of paying off Commonwealth government debt. And the Prime Minister, Mr Rudd, regularly says, listen to it. It may be an effort, but listen to it. When he talks about the reasons why Australia should be insulated from the worst excesses of the current financial instability. He says we've got a good regulatory system. He's right. It wasn't always like that. That was put in place back in the late 1980s. He says we have well-capitalised and profitable banks. We do. It wasn't always like that. Those of us who have been around a long time remember banks getting into quite considerable trouble in this country in the 1980s. He should go on and say we don't carry any government debt, which makes us different to the United States with a debt-to-GDP ratio of 50%. I'd rather go into a financial crisis with no debt and no interest payments than a $9.6 trillion debt, as the US government has, whilst they try and finance another bailout package of $700 billion, another $0.7 trillion, to add to their already debt ceiling of $9.6 trillion. Gives you a bit of strength, see. But it wasn't always like that. And I try and explain the decisions that we made to put that position in place. I'll never forget the 2007 election campaign. I was being trailed by media and cameras wherever I went, and I turned up at the Ashburton Primary School in Melbourne. And the school principal had deputised a child from each grade to ask me a question. So we started off with grade 6, and the student got up and said, "Mr Costello, can you use a computer?" "Oh, well, yes, I can, yes, yes, yes." Next question, "Mr Costello, what football team do you barrack for?" "Oh, well, barrack for the Mighty Bombers." Mr. Costello, next question. Do you have any children? Oh, yes, I've got three children. We go right down to the youngest class, the kindy class in the school. And in front of the whole school, and unknowing to him, in front of the whole press pack of Australia, this cute little kid grabs the microphone and says, Mr. Costello, my name's Rourke, and I want to know, who made cactuses? Well, it's a question of the campaign. Never stumped like that by Kerry O'Brien, I can tell you. Well, didn't the press have a field day? The banner headline in the Sydney Morning Herald the next day was, Mr. Costello, are you cactus? And I use that to explain the 2007 election campaign in the book called Going Cactus, and how we went cactus over the period of the 2007 election campaign. It should have come as no surprise to anybody. Every poll for 18 months had said that the coalition was behind. There were 50 polls in a row. AGB Nielsen, News Poll Galaxy, 50 polls in a row said the government was going to be defeated. I've never seen anything like it in my political lifetime. We actually were successful in pulling things back. At some point during that campaign, we were up to 16 points behind. John Howard, himself, used the word annihilation to describe at one point what was coming in that campaign. It's a book that also acknowledges failures. I think there were failures of our government. I think we got reconciliation wrong. And I think a movement on reconciliation earlier would have prevented the polarisation that went on and dogged the government throughout nearly 10 years. If the idea was to prevent an apology from being given or to avoid legal liability, it didn't work anyway because it's been done. And I think if we'd have taken hold of the issue earlier on and dealt with it, it would have been better. The state Liberal premiers, by and large, did that. I think we failed on the Republic. I don't think the Republic issue will go away. I think the Liberal Party should have grabbed it and used it to introduce a model with which it was in favour and comfortable, rather than leave that to other hands, which will prove a very difficult issue for the Liberal Party to handle in opposition. Much more difficult to handle in opposition than in government. And I try and write as objectively and as openly as I can about some of those failures. It's been a year since the defeat of the coalition, almost, in November of 2007. Normally when political parties lose an election, they do an analysis as to the reasons why. I believe an analysis has been done, but I'm not sure it's been released. I'm not sure if anybody in the Liberal Party has yet seen it. And you don't want to waste too much time in federal politics because it's a three-year term and we are nearly one-third over. This book may be the first serious analysis as to why we lost. And I think the party's got to come to grips with that before it starts rebuilding and positioning itself for the 2010 election. It's my contribution. I try and do it as objectively as I can to analyse the reasons. Because if you don't make the right diagnosis, you won't prescribe the right treatment. if we have a false diagnosis as to why we lost the election, we may try all sorts of things to fix it. But a treatment which doesn't address the illness is no treatment at all. And that's why I think it's very, very important that our party comes to grips with that. Let me conclude by summarising the economic record one other way. In late 2007 in Canberra, I hosted a official dinner for a visit from Lee Kuan Yew. Lee Kuan Yew was a minister mentor in the Singaporean government. They asked me to host his dinner. He's, I think, one of the great regional leaders. He's been intimately involved in the development of his country from its beginning. He sat down at dinner and started talking about the Australian prime ministers he dealt with, starting with Sir Robert Menzies. So he had quite a long engagement and knowledge of Australia. And when the dinner finished, I said to Lee Kuan Yew, I said, Minister Mintle, do you recall saying in the 1980s that Australia risked becoming the poor white trash of Asia? And he said, do I remember? He said, how could I forget? Every Australian I ever meet reminds me of it. I said, well, what's your view now? And he said, you've changed. You've changed. And we did change. We changed a lot. And we made the country much stronger economically. We were no longer the economic pariah of the region. We were seen as one of the strong economies of the region. And I think Australians' attitudes towards themselves changed as a consequence of that. And if this book can tell something of that story, then it's been well worth doing, and I thank you all for your time.
And so we come to questions and discussion. Before we do, once again, thanks to Gladys Berejiklian and the member for Willoughby who hosted this function tonight. And just a reminder, Janet Grundy's got some copies of the Costello memoirs. I think it's a terrific book, and I'm sure the Peters would be happy to sign it. At any rate, now it's finishing no later than 7 o'clock, so I ask everyone to keep their questions or their comments brief, but we're ready to roll. So, Anya. Yeah.
Wayne Swan indicated yesterday that he'd be willing to run the budget into a deficit in order to stave off any global recession coming to Australia. At what point do you think that could be appropriate? Would you have to agree with that?
Well, the budget policy that I put in place, which has been adopted by this government, was to balance the budget over the course of the cycle. And what that meant is we should be running budget surpluses while the economy is growing to give you insulation in the event that the economy started contracting. But as it turned out, the economy was growing throughout the whole of the nearly 12 years that I was Treasurer. I would say this, though, that there is no reason for the Australian budget to go into deficit. The final budget outcome, which came out last week, was released by Mr. Swan on a Friday afternoon just to make sure that it didn't get too much coverage, showed the outcome of the last budget that I did, which ended on the 30th of June 2008. It was a budget surplus of $20 billion. And it actually would have been larger if the Labor Party hadn't pulled forward a whole lot of expenditures into that financial year to try and make it look smaller. This is the only government in the Western world which has come to office with a huge budget surplus and no debt. And there is no reason whatsoever in the current climate for this government to go back into deficit.
Question up there. Yes, Mr. Costello, French President Sarkozy recently said that due to the credit crunch in America, we're going to see the end of laissez-faire capitalism economics. Do you agree or disagree?
It depends a lot what you mean by laissez-faire economics. Will we go back to a command economy? No. The liberal democratic model is so entrenched and so proven, in my view, that there'll be no reversal of that. If you mean, will we go back to a situation where financial institutions can make unwise lending decisions, sell off the risk, and expect the taxpayer to bail them out? I hope we never go back to that situation. The US financial markets, for all of their sophistication, have nothing like the prudential regulation that we have in Australia. The Federal Reserve regulates banks, but outside of that, mortgage originators essentially unregulated. And what they were doing was they were making bad loans to bad risks, selling off the mortgages, and it wasn't their problem. The problem ended up with investment banks and insurers and a whole lot of other people. I don't believe that system can continue in the United States. I think they need to get a comprehensive regulator like we have, the Prudential Regulator, APRA, which, whatever you call the institution, whether you call it a bank or a credit union or a savings and loan or a mortgage originator, can go across the field and insist on credit standards. And, you know, I would hope that coming out of this, that's what the United States actually moves to. I think there's a case for a bailout. Of course there's a case for a bailout. But I would say, and I've said this in the United States recently when I was over there for an international finance conference. You know, the savings and loans of the 1980s, the tech wreck of 2000, the subprime of 2007, isn't this telling you there's a regulatory problem in the markets in the United States? And who's thinking about the long-term solutions?
In the Weekend Australian, Mike Steckerty criticised your book for not giving Hawke enough credit. And he had also written a review of David Love's book, which praised Keating. In the Weekend Australian, Keating also responded in his usual understated way by abusing Steckerty. I wondered if you were intending to reply.
Look, I've always been honest enough to give credit to the Hawke government for what I think were good decisions. And I always name at least two. One is reducing tariffs, which was never popular, by the way, but supported by our side of politics. I give them credit for that, and I continued it. The second is, I think, freeing up the financial system. I think that was the right decision. I don't think they did it well, by the way, because we went into a lot of bad loans in the 1980s, and, you know, Keating himself claimed, you will recall, that Nobby Clark, the head of the National Australia Bank, would be selling shoelaces and pencils in Collins Street. That's what he said. Right? Right. That was the outcome of Keating's grand financial deregulation. You know, the thing about Keating, he's always good on the memorable phrase, and the problem is you remember it against him. Against him. So I'll give him credit. But in the left wing accounts of the Hawke and Keating government and the genius of Paul Keating, you know, there's one event they never talk about. It was the recession. If you listen to Keating tell the story of his economic measures, the recession never gets a look in. 11% unemployment, 17% interest rates, it's like Zia brushed out of history. It doesn't exist. You know, it's just gone. He's just a sort of great genius who presided over everything that was good. Now, I think you've got to be honest enough to actually say the task of a treasurer actually is to avoid recession, not to give us recessions we have to have. It's actually to avoid recession and to get people in work. I recommend that to Paul. Think about it.
Alexander, and then we go here. How does the Liberal Party reconnect with the people that have lost last year?
See, this is going to be the big the issue for the Liberal Party. You've got to hold these things in balance. You lost an election, so you've got to make some changes. But bear in mind, you've got millions of voters who voted for you. You don't want to make changes which will alienate them. You've got to keep the base and add to it. And the risk for the Liberal Party will be is they'll go through a phase of, say, we lost the election, so we'll throw out everything. And then they'll lose connection with their base, and then they'll say, oh, well, we better go back and reconnect with the base. And the risk will be that they'll swing from pendulum to pendulum. But what I write in this book is the Liberal Party's got to remember this. It's a centre-right party. And it represents the centre-right strand of opinion in this country. And it owes those people political representation. It will never win an election from the left. You know, believe me, when Philip Adams writes in The Australian on what the Liberal Party should do to win an election, he's not doing it because he wants a Liberal victory. Take it from me. And so you've got to remember that. And this is why an analysis as to why you lost became so important, to avoid overreaction both ways in politics. And the other thing I'd say to the Liberal Party is very important that you defend your achievements. You know, I noticed the first thing that the Labor Party started to do was to say, oh, well, you know, the economy's in terrible shape when we got elected. You won't hear that now. You know, Rudd and Swan used to say, oh, inflation, genie's out of the bottle. Oh, shocking. They're not saying that now, surprisingly enough. That all seems to have gone. That was when they were trying to work up tightening of monetary policy. Now they're trying to work up a loosening of monetary policy. Inflation, which, by the way, is probably higher today than it was in December of last year. Inflation doesn't seem to be a problem so much now.
Made the comments that in terms of your regrets about not pushing things forward like reconciliation, one of them you didn't mention was climate change.
Well, I talk in the book about the fact that I actually took a submission to the Cabinet in 2003 on an emission trading scheme. And it wasn't rejected, and I don't hold that against anybody. An ETS is hardly understood now. Imagine, put yourself back into 2003. Imagine trying to explain what an ETS was in 2003. Most of my colleagues looked at me, with their eyes crossed. I'm not saying I understand it. I understood it all that well either, by the way, in 2003. But we decided to go down the technology route. And it's not as silly as you think. I actually think a large part of the response to climate change will be led by technology. I think carbon sequestration, clean coal, I'll still be putting a lot of money on those things. But an ETS would be a backup scheme. In 2007, we came back and we actually announced we would have an ETS. There are ETSs and ETSs, believe me. And just because you give it the name ETS doesn't mean it's all of the one kind of thing. And I would have hoped that we would have done it in a more considered and measured way than I think this government is going to do it.
Shin Yin.
Go
be brief.
Mr.
Peter Kassadar, your rejection to be the leader of the opposition was wise, and your shifting out of politics could benefit you and your family, but your stay in politics could benefit this country. Would you reconsider your commitment to carry on your commitment to be to serve the people of Higgins and the people of Australia? Thank you.
Well, you know, this question is about as tricky as who made cactuses. It's a very tricky question because, the journalists ask me these sorts of questions all the time. I announced after the election that I wouldn't seek the leadership. I'd been the deputy leader for 13 and a half years. You know, it's a long time. And, you know, I knew how I felt. There'd been suggestions of transition and a handover, and they always were dashed. And I knew how it had affected me. And I thought, well, look, there's been a change of government. Time for me to give other people their go. Brendan had his go. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. Malcolm's having his go. And I really do feel that the best thing I can do for the party is to stand aside and let them have their go. I am continuing to serve my electors. I like doing that. I'm not telling you this is my this is my preferred option. I would have liked being in government more, but having had that disappointment, I'm continuing to serve my constituents. I'm doing some other things, and hopefully you'll all read in the book about the important things for Australia's future.
Question up there, and then there's one here. That'll be very quick, okay? Yep.
Hi, Mr. Costello. I live in a Labour area where, Liberal Labour is dominant in local, state, and federal. I had planned for migrants how to learn English, and I contacted more than 10 Liberal MP. All they have, they argue how they can't see me. They don't want to know what's my ideas. Can you put me, through your contacts so I can go and see somebody?
Yeah, well, I'll...
it is hard. I live in Labour-dominant. I go there, I gave him my idea.
Well, look, I can. I can put you in touch with people in the Liberal Party. I can probably even put you in touch with people in the Labour Party, but they're in government at the moment. But... I take your point, and I feel sorry for anybody that lives in a Labor area, I must say, and I'll try and liberate you if I can.
Just because there was a follow-up, we're running against time. Yeah, we've got to be quick.
Mr. Costello, in terms of analysing why you lost the election, how critically do you view the role of work choices, and what can you say to us about the effects of Julia Gillard's work choices light on Australia?
Work choices. Let's go through the constituent elements of work choices. The biggest change of work choices, by the way, was a federal takeover of industrial relations under the corporation's power. That's what it really was. No one is suggesting that be reversed. Work choices changed the unfair dismissal laws. Labor has changed them a little bit, but not totally. And I don't think anybody in small business would say we should go back to where we were. Work choices did not introduce Australian workplace agreements. They'd been in place for a long time. What it changed was the no disadvantage test, eventually to a fairness test. So, the changes, when you actually boil them down... whilst significant, were not of the dimension that some people have actually made out. Now, I believe that Australia has to keep Australian workplace agreements or individual statutory contracts. I don't care what they're called. I think that's very much in our economic interest. In fact, the ALP, which would have led you to believe it was totally opposed to these, not only allowed new AWAs to be entered into after it was elected, but is allowing those to run for 5 years. In fact, I think as Julie Bishop pointed out, AWAs will actually run longer under the Labor government than they ever did under the Coalition government. Very interesting point there. So I believe that an economy will run better on labour market flexibility. I believe that it's important that we have statutory contracts. I believe you've got to protect minimum standards. But if anybody thinks they can take this economy back to the old award system, they're nuts. They really are nuts.
We could go on night, but we're right on 7, so I think we'll close it there. Many thanks.
Thank you, Jerry.
Very brief. Congratulations to MEP and to Peter Coleman and Peter Costello for the book. We've had a terrific night tonight, and I've often thought that of the In the last decade, the last half century in Australian politics, there have been four politicians, I believe, of genuine wit in the federal parliament, in no particular order. Mick Young and Paul Keating on the Labor side, and Bert Kelly and Peter Costello on the Liberal side. And we've seen that tonight. It's been a fun night, but also an important night, because it's an important book. But a bit of humour always helps. And so congratulations to all concerned. I hope the book goes well. Janet Grundy's got copies up the back. The Peters will be happy to sign it down the front. Peters are going to sign it up the back. So for tonight, I'd only do what I'm told here. So thank you and well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.